I have a couple of observations at the beginning, one of which is that after our conversation about Zeno and his paradoxes, in which I thought I had made a perfectly lucid explanation of it all, I get a tome from Mr. Kimball, 100 pages on that topic. So now it makes me wonder, why am I teaching this class, you know? So if you actually want to know anything about the topic of Zeno and his paradoxes, then I refer you to Mr. Kimball, please, because he has studied this vastly more deeply than
That's
I have.
That's a nice way of saying you didn't read it.
No, I did read it. I didn't get it, but I did read it. No, it was very good, very thought-provoking. I read, to be perfectly honest, about the first half of it, because that was the part you suggested that I read, yeah. Secondly, as requested by Ms. Holland, this is being recorded. So, yeah, so anything you say may come back to haunt you. Anybody know what these are? What all those words are? What do they all have in common? They are all? Yes. Excellent. Did you hear that?
No. Yeah. And I was in the second row.
Figures of speech.
Figures of speech.
They are all.
Did you take the marker? Is the marker?
I have a ring guard. I have a ring guard still.
No, keep it. I don't know what happened to it. I had one good marker. Did you take it? Okay. All right. So, let's pray. We'll get going. Father, we're grateful for your continual mercies to us. We thank you for the opportunity to explore these great thinkers in history, to think about them in terms of our own faith understanding. We pray that you'd bring light and clarity as we review these matters and give you thanks in Jesus' name. Amen. Last time we looked at, I'll abbreviate, Parmenides, Heraclitus. Parmenides' famous statement was, famous, went down in history. We remember him because he said,
whatever is, is.
Yes. Whatever is, is. Subpoint, all else is illusory. And he proves it through his apologist, representative, whose name was Zeno. And how does Zeno prove that there's only one fixed, permanent, eternal reality? And all appearance of change is illusory. How does Zeno prove that?
The arrow.
Be one of the three. Actually, he had many paradoxes. Those are the most famous. Proving that motion itself is absurd, you know. But as I say, I think it's been answered. I think. But I don't want to spend time on that. Heraclitus, on the other hand, his famous statement was, there's several of them, but what would be one of them?
The only thing permanent is.
Thank you. Excellent. Right. So these two are in a conflict, and as often happens in the history of thought, you find that there's what's called an impasse, in which some people side with Parmenides, some people side with Heraclitus, and some people just throw up their hands in despair and say, I don't know. Because you got one genius on one hand, and he seems to be very cogent and persuasive, and then you listen to the other guy, and he seems equally, you know, compelling, and you just go, I'm just a man on the street. I don't know how to resolve this thing, you know, so you just kind of despair. And it gives rise to a period of skepticism. And so in the Greek world, there was skepticism for some time. Oddly enough, the period of skepticism in Greek history, also goes by the name the... Anybody have any idea? It's called the... I'll give you a hint. It's basically the years from about 460 down to about 4, let's say 30. Would be the heart of it. And it's called the what? The Dark Ages. No, it's the Greek Golden Age, you see. It's the Greek Golden Age. Pericles and, all of those people who were attracted to Athens. It was also a time of democracy, because democracy really stands for an idea of a kind of skepticism of higher truth, and says to determine truth, we're going to count noses. You know, we're just going to say whoever votes for it, whoever gets the majority, must be correct. And so you have these two traditions that come down, and then this period of skepticism. And of course, during that 5th century BC, you also have Greece involved in a lot of warfare. So what are the two great wars that are fought in Greece during the 5th century BC? They are, Mr. Ingard?
27-year nightmare that wrecks Greece.
Exactly, which we otherwise know as Peloponnesian Wars. And before that, we have, of course, the Persian Wars. So you got Persian Wars, Peloponnesian Wars, in the middle, Golden Age, go figure. But after this period of self-destruction that we call the Peloponnesian Wars, there's kind of a great malaise that lands over the Greek world. And it's really out of that self-reflection, I think, that it calls forth then a more thoughtful, pensive exploration of what's it really all about. And that brings us to Plato. The period of skepticism, this is a very gross oversimplification, but I'm going to say there were essentially two schools of thought that were most important. One would be called the Sophists, and one would be called the Cynics. There were others, but these would be the most memorable and important. The Sophists were kind of the Madison Avenue ad men. They said, hey, we don't know what the real truth of the matter is. We don't know what's true in a higher transcendent order, and we don't really care. What we do care about is how to win friends and influence people, how to make money, how to get your way, how to influence the masses, how to be a good demagogue and manipulate public opinion so that you get elected. You can promise people anything and get just about anything you want if you make enough extravagant promises and you do it the right way. So it's really, oddly enough, the birth of the great science of rhetoric, which, of course, we teach here. And it always reminds me of something someone said in law school once. I was in an evidence class. And the guy who was speaking to us, a guest lecturer who was a lawyer and a psychologist, said, when you get out of law school and pass the bar, you'll get the social equivalent of an M16, And I've thought about that with our Oaks students. We teach them powerful communication skills, and some of them get to be very good at it. And I can imagine by 10 or 15 years from now, if they continue to hone those skills, they will have the equivalent of an M16, And that's why we have to mix our training in rhetoric with deep, principled conviction in God's Word. Otherwise, you just create these demagogues, these, people who can do great damage through the power of speech. The most famous of the Sophists was a fellow by the name of, anybody know? Take a stab. Mr. Kimball? What?
Gorgias?
Nah, that'd be a good guess. It's not who I have in mind, but we could debate that. Anybody?
Isocrates.
Isocrates is a little later. Or actually a little earlier. No. He's a little later. He's Alexander. Protagoras. Protagoras famously said, homo mensura. You've all heard that, haven't you? Almost. Mensura. You've probably heard the translation of it, if you didn't hear it. Man is the table. That's
that
right. Man the what? Man the measure. Leonardo da Vinci was very much taken with that idea. And out of his musings came this very famous little diagram, which is intended to illustrate the principle, man the measure. You know, well, the Greeks were thinking this way, and that is in part what drove the design of the Colosseum, which I just learned the other day watching a wonderful video that Ms. Garfield was showing to the... So anyway, this was a time in which... You know, what does it mean to say man is the measure? If man is the measure, that's a denial of anything transcendent. It's saying there's no truth up there. There's no ultimate standard by which I gauge right and wrong. It all comes down to man. And that's the essence of humanism. And that's really what happens. When you can't resolve the big issues, when you can't get the greatest thinkers to agree, then you wind up in a period of skepticism where you say, well, we don't know. We'll just simply say, we are the ultimate standard of truth, which is kind of a scary proposition, you know, to say that. Mr. Inger.
I was just thinking this. So would you say that somebody like Christopher Hitchens is just a modern antagonist?
Maybe, yeah. I don't know enough about him to really give much of an intelligent response, but my kind of casual impression. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The other school of thought is associated, let me ask you this, who would be the most famous cynic of ancient Greek history? And the answer is, Mr. Ingard, once again,
Diogenes.
And what do you know about Diogenes? Anybody except Mr. Ingard know anything about Diogenes? Anybody? What?
Didn't he tell Alexander the Great to get out of the way?
Yes, that's right. One of many great lines. It may be apocryphal, but the story is that Diogenes is laying there in the nude, of course. He always was in the nude. And in the sun in his wooden bathtub, getting some sunshine. And Alexander was excited to meet him because he's a famous philosopher. And Alexander came up and saw him and asked him, "What is there anything I can do for you?" I think that was it. Alexander, conqueror of the world. Is there anything I can do for you? He's so taken with meeting the famous Diogenes. And Diogenes says, "Would you get out of the way? You're in my sun." You know, so that's, isn't that the perfect cynic? But I'm old enough. I was actually there. That's what students always tell me. So I caught this digital photo of Diogenes. He's the guy in the wooden tub down there. You can kind of, not a great shot. You see him? He actually has clothes on here, so it's okay to look. Yeah. See that? And Diogenes is most famous, however, not for telling Aristotle to get out of his sun, but for a famous line that he said as he wandered through the Greek agora, the Athenian agora. And it was, anybody know? Mr. Ingard, you know all this stuff. I'm looking for what kind of man?
Well, I think the most brutal way of putting it is I'm looking for a man.
All right, well, I've heard the quote, an honest man. So the picture of Diogenes is he's going through, in broad daylight, the Greek, you know, the Athenian agora, with a torch, light lit there. And he's looking in every corner. Of course, it's broad daylight. He said, "What are you doing? You know, what are you up to?" "I'm looking for an honest man, you know." Because, of course, nobody's honest. Everybody's a liar. And the cynics had that attitude. So they took a little bit, you know, the sophists are more optimistic. Man the measure, you know, kind of humanistic. The cynics are, try to be polite about this, the root of the word for cynic, you know, going back to its Greek roots, is a word that was used to describe what certain male dogs would do with fire hydrants. That was what Diogenes was doing with society. You see, there's no honest people. Everything is just nonsense, meaningless. You know, so they were the, I've often thought, kind of like the hippies, you know, had that kind of Diogenes attitude. So this is the period of skepticism. This is when nobody's giving big answers, just little answers. Little answers like how to be happy by manipulating public opinion, or little answers about there's no meaning, and just kind of thumbing your nose at all of society. Yeah.
Which is, would you say, where we are now?
Absolutely. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. I think really, you know, the whole postmodern attitude is, you know, a lot like that. All right. So that's Greek thought kind of languishes for a while. And then along comes, of course, Plato. And this is tough to know just how to cover Plato in, you know, half an hour or so. So I'm being extremely selective, and I give my advanced apologies to you who are expert in this subject matter for my rather selective treatment of him. But Alfred North Whitehead probably gave one of the most famous quotes ever given about Plato, which is as follows. You don't need to try to take this down, but it's a famous quote. The safest characterization of the European philosophical tradition is that it consists of a series of footnotes to Plato. You know. So all the other philosophers, all the other great thinkers are just footnotes, you know, to Plato. He was the guy. And so we want to try to give him at least a little bit of his due. And the way I want to approach this is, as I've indicated on the little outline you have there, just kind of methodical. We'll think about his ontology, his epistemology, and then out of that we'll have a couple other little things to say. Because you know what ontology is and you know what epistemology is, because we talked about that last week. Plato is a great synthesizer. So he is taking a contribution from Parmenides and a contribution from Heraclitus, and this happens multiple times down through, you know, philosophical reflection, and he tries to pull together the best of both. So he's trying to give the answer. Parmenides, Heraclitus leave us with this unresolved dilemma. He wants to resolve it. He wants to say, here is the way we put the picture together. But Plato is taking about, I'm going to say, 70% of his answer from Parmenides and only about 30% from Heraclitus. So he likes Parmenides more than he likes Heraclitus, but he's trying to incorporate both. Now, the way I want to try to illustrate this is by showing you a couple of famous pieces of art. One, I hope you'll all recognize. I hope you can all see it. Y'all recognize that? Famous piece of art. They're dropping like flies. That, of course, is known as what? The Mona Lisa. And then there's another great piece of art, competitive with it, one that I think you might almost say if you're going to just measure straight up beauty, but it's not a piece as well known in history, but I want you to see it now, and I want you to kind of judge which you think captures beauty a little more. This is called the Betty Sue.
Oh, yeah.
You like that? I worked on that for hours, and I'm assuming that sometime after I'm dead, I'll go down in history as one of the great contributors to art. So you got the Mona Lisa, the Betty Sue. Ms. Holland, be honest. Which of these would you say is reflective of greater beauty?
I'd have to go for the Mona Lisa.
You would? Close call. You know, if you looked at this a little longer, you might have to, you know. See, and I have not improved since the first grade either. That's exactly what my artwork has looked like for the last 60 years. Now, You realize that you live in a culture in which there are people who would argue with a straight face that there is no way to know which one is more beautiful. And they would say of Miss Holland and her expression of her opinion, what? They would say, that's your opinion. But who's to say that someone might not come along and see in this a great, you know, a great expression of genius and say, no, actually, the Betty Sue. Now, Plato was worried about that. Plato was worried about this conversation we are having right now in which we might engage in an actual debate over which is the more beautiful. Because Plato wants us to know that there is not simply a subjective answer to that question, which is a function of Ms. Holland's taste, but that there's an objective answer to the question, which is true whether or not Ms. Holland votes the right way. You follow that? There's one of these two that is actually, objectively, more beautiful than the other. And Plato is worried that we don't miss that point, because he anticipated the National Endowment for the Arts, which would take elephant dung and smear it on a picture of the Virgin Mary and say, that's art. You know? That's what your tax dollars have been paying for in the last few years. You know that. Or take a crucifix and put it in a beaker of urine and say, that's art. And I say, no, that's blasphemy. They say, well, wait a minute, who's to say that? Who says that that's not art? You know? And Plato is very concerned that we not fall into that trap, which is exactly the trap we have fallen into, of not having any measure of what's truly beautiful. And so his answer to this is by saying, the reason that the Mona Lisa is actually more beautiful than the Betty Sue is not because we go around the room and we all vote and the Mona Lisa wins, or that some other private subjective determination is going on, but that what, even if we all voted against the Mona Lisa, it would still be the more beautiful, because he says there is, I don't know how to picture this, so I'll just do it this way. There is beauty, which I can spell sometimes. Not today. There is a third thing. There is the Mona Lisa, there's the Betty Sue, and there's something else, and it is not us, right? There is something other than those two, which we can use to gauge these two, and by making that evaluation, we can say, yep, the Mona Lisa is actually more beautiful, in fact, not just in opinion. You know. And so to get there, Plato has to give us what he calls a world of ideas. And in that world of ideas, there is an idea of beauty. There's also an idea of what? What else would be in that idea? Goodness. There's also an idea of?
Truth.
Truth. There's also an idea of, we could go on for quite a while with this.
Chair.
What, pardon me?
Chair.
Chair, that's right. There is the perfect, archetypal, eternal, essential, unchanging chair. This is not it. Excuse me. I'm destroying our property here. I'm very sorry, Mr. Dowers. I'll just tuck that under there and maybe he won't notice. Oh. How many secrets are hiding around this place? So I look at this chair, and I could call it a chair, according to Plato, because it participates in an eternal chair that is actually called, do you know this? Chairness. Right. Mathematical truth is there. There is, of course, in this perfect world, the perfect circle, the perfect triangle, the perfect, you know, numeric truth is there. There's the perfect propositions. so on. So he goes on and on with this, but you get the idea. These truths, these realities are there, not because we put them there. We have nothing to do with it. They are simply there as a matter of the objective order of reality, and whether we like it or not, it really is very much the truth of the universe in which we live. We can vote against it. We may not like it. We can kick against it. But there it is. Then he says down here is what he calls, I've heard this called by various terms, but we'll call it the receptacle. So at least one way of distinguishing these is the ideal world and the receptacle world. The receptacle world, the term actually comes from his myth of creation, in which one of the factors, one of the four factors in creation, this is in his Timaeus dialogue, is the receptacle. It'd be kind of like the mixing bowl if you're making a cake, and we live in the mixing bowl world, we live in the receptacle world. So that is, I think most of you are familiar with this. I'm sure I'm just giving you what you're aware of. But that's probably the most famous single aspect of Plato's thought, is his distinction between these two worlds. And of course, this receptacle world, being a world of copies, is imperfect, because nothing that we experience in this receptacle world is quite the same as the eternal thing in which it participates. That chair is imperfect. And for Plato, being imperfect is to be a little bit evil. So he has what's called a metaphysical understanding of evil. Evil is associated with being imperfect, you see, part of the receptacle order. So true perfection, true virtue, is connected to this ideal, but that's not immediately accessible to us. We live down here, kind of trapped in this receptacle order. So far, so good. Pretty straightforward. Questions, comments?
Bruce, so is it Plato or Lewis who calls our world the shadow?
Actually, Plato does, and that's what I'm going to talk about in just a second. He calls it that in his cave. Kind of metaphor, yeah. All right, so that's his ontology. His ontology is the question, what is real? For him, what is real is what is up at the level of the ideal. And down here, this is less real. This is the shadow side. Now, his epistemology is, of course, connected directly to that. And his epistemology has to do with the question, how do we know what is real? So the question is, how do we know this, ideal world? How do we know it? What is his answer? Who knows the answer that Plato gives? It's a great Platonic answer to the question, how do we know this? I've never been there that I can recall, although I have to be very careful saying that way. But I can't go there. I can't, let's go on a field trip to the ideal world and take a look at it. How do I know that it's there, according to Plato? Anybody? Anybody besides Mr. Ingard? Mr. Dowers?
Does it have to do with, we remember it from,
yes,
before we were born?
That's right. So he has an idea of your soul existing before you came into this physical life. And your soul was there. Somehow or other, that's your soul. And you experienced the ideal realities, these eternal, you saw them, or somehow experienced them. And now you have been trapped in the prison house of your body, and your memory is a little fuzzy. The thoughts are there. You still do have an idea, don't you, of beauty? Didn't Miss Holland recognize that the Mona Lisa is more beautiful than the Betty Sue? Where did she get that idea? Somehow we don't want to say it was just her private opinion. We want to say, no, there was an objective truth to that answer. We say, where'd you get that idea? And you would just say, what? How did you know the Mona Lisa was more beautiful than the Betty Sue? How did you know? You just,
it looked more beautiful.
It just looked more beautiful. You just knew it. Plato says, well, how did you know it? You know, if we walked a giraffe in here and said, which is more beautiful, do you think the giraffe could make a right judgment about that? Probably not, because giraffes haven't been to the ideal world. You know, it's people who have that intuition of a perfect circle, perfect goodness, perfect truth, perfect beauty. We have it lodged in our DNA. Where did it come from? Plato says we must have been there sometime in the past. And now here we are living in the shadow, really, of those things that we recall. He proves this in an interesting way in one of his dialogues that we read, Mr. Williams, some time back. Do you recall the name of the dialogue? Do you remember it? We all know.
I can't remember. Yeah.
No, no. It's called the... Anybody remember? Do you remember, Ben? Called the... Meno. The Meno Dialogue. And what is the basic storyline of the Meno Dialogue? Do you remember, Kevin, what's going on in the Meno?
I'll try.
Go ahead, Mr. Williams.
Plato and who's he having a dialogue
with? It's Socrates is always the hero. So Socrates is talking
to Meno.
Meno.
They're talking about what is virtue.
Okay.
And trying to define what virtue is. And they pull in this little boy. And the fact that this little boy knew the answers to these mathematical questions wasn't because he had been taught,
right,
but because of his, well, before he was born.
Right. Yeah. So there you go. It's very good. So Socrates says, he proposes to Meno, the slave owner, I bet if you brought in a slave boy, I could show you that he knows the Pythagorean theorem, even though he's never studied it. Meno goes, come on. Uneducated slave boy knows the Pythagorean theorem? I don't think so. And so they bring in this slave boy. And Socrates begins through a series of well-crafted questions, beginning very simply, to lead that, although I have to say, between you and me, Mr. Williams, that is a very obtuse argument he makes. I read it and read it. I'm not sure it quite got me to the Pythagorean theorem. But the theory is that you walk through these questions, increasingly difficult questions to a little uneducated slave boy, and eventually you can show that he actually knew the Pythagorean theorem even though he'd never studied it, you see. So that's the argument. And so that gives rise then to a whole theory of education that says the best way to teach people is not to just simply say things to them, but to try to do what? Draw it out of them. And we call that what? The Socratic method, you know. And so the Meno really in some ways is a great illustration of this Socratic method. And we don't object to that. In fact, let me ask you this. As Christians, do we object to the idea that there is objective beauty? Do we object to that idea? No. But where do we find objective beauty? As Christians, we find it where?
Jesus.
Sure. Thank you. Sunday school. Yeah, we find it. We don't find it just in an abstract ideal world. We find it in the mind of God. You know, we say there are perfect circles in the world because there's a perfect circle in God's mind, and we think God's thoughts after him in some sense that we have that. So, you know, we say, Plato, you were onto something. You were actually walking down the right path. You just didn't quite get far enough. In fact, let me ask you this. From a Christian point of view, he has his idea of the good. That's really his highest standard. That's the apex of his ideas in the ideal world. We as Christians would actually, I believe, take one step further and say it's even beyond the idea of the good is a higher value, that we would say even goodness flows from that. Now, I may be out on a limb here a little bit, but anybody have an idea what I have in mind here? What word would we use that we would say is the most profound description of the heart of what God is that really gives rise to all of the rest of this?
Start with a P or an A.
It's holiness. Okay. Yeah. God is holy. Plato never gets to holiness. He gets to goodness, which is well on the way, you know, not to be disparaged, but we would say from a biblical point of view, we don't say God is good, good, good. We say God is holy, holy, holy. And it brings in the reverential you know, aspect of it. All right, so we remember it. Let me just, I want to show you a little clip here that is the way that Plato illustrates this. And it's based on his little cave story. Somebody must know the cave. I know. What's the cave? Anybody know the story of the cave? The cave parable? It's in the Republic.
Plato's Republic.
It is? Do you remember it? What is it?
I remember it. It's just the people just going through the motion. I can't.
Okay. That's the idea.
Weren't there like people that are chained to
the
ground and they're facing the back of the cave? All they see is shadows.
Right.
So that's what they see as reality.
Okay.
But they don't realize that there are people behind them casting the shadows.
Right.
And then when one of them's free, they connect to them and start to try to go out the cave. But then before they can come back to tell everybody, the people behind try to tell them.
Excellent. Okay. So just think about what we've talked about. And you want to get, thanks, Charlie. Eric.
You could have also just put in the matrix and you got the
I suppose, it is kind of reminds you of the matrix a little bit, doesn't it? Yeah. How do you interpret now what you know from Plato? What is the meaning of the cave parable? What's the message that it's a pretty faithful reproduction of what you would read in his about page and a half cave parable. What's the story there? Ms. Allard, interpret it, construe.
I'm going to try and...
What is the cave? What is it?
Our experience.
Okay, and we call that in terms of Plato's cosmology, what do we call that? The?
She can't read it.
She can't read my writing. The receptacle. The cave is the receptacle world, right? We're sitting here looking at each other. I look at Lucy and I think, you know, there's a lovely math teacher and so on. Little do I know, I am merely looking at a shadow. You know, this is not real. But I think it is because it's all I've ever experienced. Who is it that gets drug outside and sees the real world? Who is that? In Plato's overall outlook, that would be who?
Philosopher.
Any philosopher. The true philosopher is the one who goes out and sees, as it were, the beatific vision. Sees reality. Sees the sun. Sees real flowers, real color. And realizes how totally impoverished is the life people are living in this receptacle world. And the philosopher wants to stay there and bask in that world of great transcendent truth, but realizes, filled with love for his friends in the cave, he goes back to save them. And how is he treated by the people in the cave? What's their response to him? Ms. Woodruff, do they buy it? They treat him like he's some kind of idiot. And that's why Plato says philosophers are treated so poorly. And that's why they seem so weird. Because they've seen the light. And all the rest of us are just in this poor, pathetic, shadowy world in which we don't appreciate their great insight and truth. Yeah.
So would he say then that Parmenides and Heraclitus are saying the same thing? Only we are not hearing them, and he comes along and he synthesizes them into a new voice, and we continue to not all saying the same thing.
Well, not quite. He's not that much of a relativist. He says Parmenides was saying a truth and Heraclitus was saying a truth, but Parmenides was saying a little more of the truth. And so his, you have to say this ideal world is Plato's tipping his hat to Parmenides. The receptacle world is him accommodating Heraclitus. The receptacle world is the world, the only world Heraclitus ever saw. The world of change, the world of imperfection. Heraclitus never quite got here. So he thinks Parmenides is closer. But he doesn't like Parmenides, goes a little too far. That there is, for Parmenides, there is no receptacle. That's purely illusory. He wants to accommodate something of Heraclitus, you know. So it's a synthesis, a compromise, really. So I wouldn't say, it's not like Hegel, where Hegel would say both the thesis and the antithesis are both true. You know, that would be Hegelianism. Plato isn't quite that way. He does believe there's a true answer here. So far, so good, right? Is it warm in here? It is, isn't it? See?
Is this the same idea as in Corinthians and Paul says we see through the last
one? Well, you could certainly draw a parallel there. I would be hesitant to say it's the same thing, because I don't think Paul was much of a Platonist, but yeah, you could.
But it's the same.
Yeah, same idea. We're not mm-hmm. Yeah, basically. Sure. Mm-hmm. And I think, again, as Christians, we can see some correlation to what we understand to be the case. Charlie?
Do we know at all if Plato had interactions with our scriptures?
You know, that's been a debated point. I think the consensus of opinion is that he did not. But he did travel, and certainly it's conceivable. I mean, you know, he's in Greece, and he certainly made it to Egypt. And there's some argument that he even made it over into parts of Mesopotamia. So it's not hard to imagine he could have gotten to the Holy Land. But he never makes any particular reference in his writings that would say, aha, that's truly biblical or Hebraic or... You know, so, but there are some who would say he had to have had some contact with them to have come up with what he did. And I'm agnostic on the point. I don't know. Yeah.
How does Plato know that he's right? What standard in his epistemology does he use to determine his synthesis?
It's sort of the same argument. He would say every one of us in this room has this idea of true beauty, true goodness, a perfect circle, and so on. And then he just simply unabashedly says, and I've thought about it more deeply than the rest of you, you know. So you have to kind of take his word for it. He doesn't have any credential he throws on the table and says, this proves it. But he just is, his arguments... In other words, you read the Phaedo dialogue, for example, and you're supposed to think, wow, anybody that could come up with that must be the person that really gets it. And so you're just persuaded by his, you know.
Brilliance.
His brilliance, yeah.
Just in the Phaedo dialogue, he proposed that the universe was shaped in a dodecahedron because it's the largest regular solid. And when they did the microwave background radiation scans, the wavelengths, there were only certain shapes the wavelengths could fit in, and one of them was dodecahedron.
Is that in the Phaedo? I don't think I've seen that in the Phaedo. Because I have the kids. I don't think that's in the Phaedo, but that's interesting. I'd like to know where that is. That's very interesting. All right, a couple more things before we... There is in Plato another little theme in him that's been very important in the history of Christianity is what's called Plato's dualism. What does the word dualism mean? What is a dualism? You hope your marriage is not a dualism. What is a dualism? Okay, it can be equal and opposite, not necessarily equal, but certainly opposite, in which you have two forces in a struggle. Difference between dualism and simply being dual or a duality is you can have two things that aren't in a struggle. But the ism adds the notion of conflict. And in Plato, it's been observed that you have three areas where there's a true dualism going on. This is what drove Aristotle crazy. It's what he was trying to fix in Plato, is the dualism. The first dualism in Plato is called metaphysical. And that is the dualism, as it were, between the ideal and the receptacle. That in a sense, the imperfect is in a struggle with the perfect. And the imperfect being tainted is always going to be kind of detracting from, sabotaging, undermining the perfect. Just as the cave distracts us from reality, we get absorbed in the shadows, and we think that's all there is. this metaphysical dualism is preventing us from seeing what is actually real, you know. So that's the first level, kind of a struggle between the perfect and the imperfect. Then there is what's often called his anthropological. When in doubt, scribble. Dualism. I shouldn't be doing this in here. I mean, I have Miss Muse in the back of the room, for Pete's sake. I should be. So that's why I'll never make it as a second grade teacher. I'll just never get there. But, you know. What do you suppose is meant by an anthropological dualism? Miss Muse, you've been rather quiet here, and it's the one time I always have to actually pick on people. What do you think? Anthropological dualism. What do you think that would be suggesting? Yes. Yeah. Anthropos, man. The idea?
Would it be between the philosophers and those who...
Good thought. Good thought. I'll help you a little bit. It's actually the struggle going on in each individual man or woman. So it's not necessarily between people, but within each person. What would that be? What struggle is Plato famous for that's inside each one of us, Charlie? Okay, yeah, our body and soul, you know. Because the soul really represents in me the ideal world. The soul is that part of me that has its roots up there in that which is perfect and eternal, but the body is temporal, imperfect, and in Plato's kind of great scheme of things, our soul is trapped inside our body. And the body wants to drag us in the direction of bodily things, which are not good for the soul. So what I need to do is emphasize the life of the soul, the contemplative life, the philosophical life, the mental life, and I need to de-emphasize the life of the body. I need to, in a sense, be rigorous with the body. I need to... I mean, he pushes us a little bit down the road toward a kind of asceticism where I punish the body in order to liberate the soul, right? Think that's had any influence in Christian history, that idea? And so this anthropological dualism says that we are divided against ourselves substantially. Now, Paul talks about flesh and spirit, and some people look at that and say, ah, look at there. Paul was a Platonist. Because he's got flesh and spirit, and Plato had body and soul. Man, they sound kind of like the same terms. Therefore, Paul is just warmed over Plato. You know, you'll hear that. I think that's incorrect, if you're interested, but you certainly see at least a person could make that argument. Plato says the fight is between that part of you which is material and that part of you which is immaterial, your body and your soul. The third dualism is an epistemological dualism. And this is the conflict between what he calls knowledge as opposed to opinion. What do you suppose the difference is between knowledge and opinion? That creates a... I'm sorry?
About 10 or 20 years.
Oh, that's very good. There's a smart aleck in every class. What do you think, Mr. Palpin? What's the difference in Plato between knowledge and opinion? I've kind of hinted at it the way I've put it there.
One is the receptacle.
Yeah, isn't that good? See, Miss Woodruff did get that. Knowledge is what we get from our reflection on the ideal world. That is the real truth of the universe. Opinion is simply what Matt Dykstra teaches you. He's not here, so I... You know, he takes you over to... Who cares? He goes to Mount St. Helens... You look at a mountain, you look at a pine tree, you look at squirrels, who cares? That's all down here. What we want to know about is what's really important, which is up here. That's knowledge. Down here, you just get opinion. I mean, what can a scientist give you? He can give you probabilities. He can give you observations. He can give you imperfect, you know, understanding of things. So he's not much of a scientist. He is a philosopher. And of course, Aristotle, as you know, comes along to balance that. Aristotle is a great scientist. For him, all the action is down here. But Plato leaves us with that kind of dualism, that the real knowledge that we need to have is knowledge that comes, in a sense, through the inward, you know, exploration, the exploration of the mind, reason, rationality, rather than observation. Yeah.
How does one get to that reflection of the ideal world of forms without passing through experience?
Yeah.
Or what we see around us?
Yeah. I don't think he has a great answer for that. He has, in other words, I think if you really put Plato under the microscope, it's a little simplistic, you know, and that's exactly what Aristotle said. He just thinks Plato is a little bit too, he's ignoring too much here, you know. Even Plato has to say, the reason I know that the perfect chair is up there is because I've seen a few perfect imperfect chairs down here. So there's a little bit of observation. Even in Plato's understanding. He doesn't deny this level, but he really de-emphasizes it, you know. So, concluding, how has Plato influenced our Christian history? He's influenced it positively in some ways. You know, the early apologists for the church, Justin Martyr, and others, certainly the Alexandrian Christian apologist Clement, Origen, you know, really gave heavy credit to Plato. They were Platonists. Platonism has a big role down through Christian history. Some people would say Francis Schaeffer was a great Platonist, you know, and I think he probably was. Plato's also had a negative influence. Certainly his tendency to attach to the body a kind of taint, you know, has given rise to all kinds of not only asceticism, but in some cases a kind of masochistic element in Christian history. We think of medieval monks, you know, who would beat themselves bloody with whips. Why do you do that? You know, well, there's a conviction behind that. There's a philosophy behind that that says my body is the evil part of me, and I need to beat it up. Like Paul says, I pummel my body. Well, I don't think Paul had quite in mind the medieval monks at that point, you know, but you get that sort of impulse there, that there's a kind of a wicked side to my body that needs to be discouraged. A negative view of the world, you know. Plato doesn't have much interest in nature, pine trees. It's kind of a Gnostic sort of thing. You think about what happened in the second and third centuries where this world is disparaged and everything is about the soul and the mind and kind of the upward glance, and you think that's, you know, a Platonic influence. His view of evil. Christianity views evil as a truly moral thing. There's a moral evil. He makes it more metaphysical. That's the difference, in my opinion, between biblical Christianity and Christian science. In Christian science, evil is connected to that which is just sort of not real. It's a metaphysical idea of evil, but it loses its teeth. There's no real robust sense that wickedness is a powerful thing that I need to combat in my life. You know, it kind of minimizes that, suggests I just need to sort of float up to this higher level, and then I'll be okay, and at other points.